Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program that brings you insights, observations, and analysis of the economic dimensions of our lives. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. I also write commentary for truthout.org, a remarkable independent source of news and analysis that I urge you to check out, truthout.org. We also maintain two websites that allow you to follow the kinds of work we do in great detail, as much as you're interested. The two websites are open 24/7 at absolutely no charge. The first one is rdwolf.com, rdwolf.com. And the other one is Democracy at Work, all one word, democracyatwork.info. Not only can you follow our work there, but you can also send us your comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms. We read every one and use them to shape this program. And finally, both websites offer you the opportunity, simply by clicking on an icon, to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, which we urge you to do to have a more regular relationship to the kind of work presented on this program. Let's jump right into it. I have something I'm very proud of about America in a way, and something I'm ashamed of, and I thought I'd start today with those. On Friday, July 25th, I will be a guest of the Bill Maher program, Real Time. Some of you will hear this broadcast before then, I urge you to watch. Some of you will hear about it afterwards, I urge you to pursue via archives that opportunity as well. Bill Maher has invited me to talk about economic issues, and I think it's a testimony to the openness and the courageousness of American television to move in this direction, and I'm proud and honored to have been invited. The second thing is something that was so shocking to me that even though it isn't strictly speaking economics, I had to talk to you about it. This last week, the state of Arizona took 2 hours to execute a human being. The person was alleged by many witnesses to have suffered God knows what kind of pain and agony in those 2 hours of a botched execution, which did finally kill him. He's also waited for years, as most victims of official executions have to do, and the suffering of waiting for years when you don't know whether you're going to live or die is something I find difficult to imagine. Most world religions have a prohibition on killing people, and in most cases there are not a long list of exceptions about when it's okay. It's basically immoral, unethical, and violates the tenets of an awful lot of the world's religions. Most advanced industrial countries, indeed most countries in the world, ban capital punishment. We, for some reason, don't. It is extremely hurtful to wait for years not knowing whether you're going to live or die. That seems to me cruel and inhuman punishment. What happened in Arizona, following by a few weeks what happened in another state, is beyond my comprehension at the level of cruelty and inhumanity it is. And finally, executions are an extremely costly way of dealing with a problem. And when I hear the excuses, companies don't want a bad reputation, companies didn't do enough testing on the drugs, I am even more horrified. If we can't manage to do this correctly, this horrible action, then for sure we should never have tried it on a human being unless and until we can make it perfect. And if we can't, that's one more reason not to do it. It is astonishing to me that we permit in this day and age. We know how fallible juries can be. We know there's a presumption of innocence even after 12 honest people have made a determination of guilt. Imprisonment, punishment, yes. Relief for the people who suffered the crime, for sure. But killing human beings, a very dangerous practice that leads to even more dangerous practices. So much for my upset about it, but I thought I would share it with you because it simply needed to be spoken. Turning now to our regular updates, quickly, so I can get in many of them. I'm responding here to some of you who said you'd like less analysis, at least at the beginning of the program, and more going through examples of things you want to be able to think about, so I'm going to try to accommodate. Over the last week, a remarkable series of actions in Seattle, Washington. a city that is surprising us in many ways, having to do with politics and economics. A veteran, an American war veteran, and his wife were threatened with eviction. They were struggling in the courts to prevent being evicted. The veteran in question is wheelchair-bound, and he has been struggling with his wife to be able to stay in their home. The eviction was ordered. The sheriff came to throw these folks out of their home, and a group of civic-minded people said, no, we won't tolerate it. An American veteran who still has legal recourses available to him should not be put out of his home. It's an even an open question whether he ever should be put out of his home, with or without the legal decisions in this case. But they would not let the sheriff leave. The sheriff came with his folks to do his job, and the protester said, we have no quarrel with you, but you cannot do this thing because we have a quarrel with evicting an elderly veteran of the United States. And an interesting thing happened. Politics is changing in America. The mayor ordered the sheriff to back down. The people were not evicted. The sheriff said he wants to see the legal processes exhausted before anything like an eviction is contemplated. And even more, a number of local politicians commented that the police and the sheriff's office have many higher priorities of issues the community is concerned about that are way more important than evicting elderly folks from their home. Interesting. People are analyzing economic reality and making some decisions and shaping how political and legal activities happen. People acting make a difference, it turns out. On the other side of the country, in New England, in particularly Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and I believe also Maine, another intervention by people, quite different, but yet again a sign that economic outcomes that used to be thought of as automatic, necessary, part of the way the world works, turn out to be not that, turn out to be amenable to people believing something and acting together to make a difference. This time it concerns a chain of supermarkets. They're called the Market Basket Company, or the Market Basket Supermarket Chain. It's a closely held company owned by the family that began the business. I hope I'm pronouncing it right, Demoulas family. And it's been in a struggle among the members of that family how to run the business. And in particular, two brothers, Arthur T. Demoulas and Arthur S. Demoulas, have been struggling with various members of their family on the board of directors of this very big chain, siding with one or the other. But here's where it gets interesting. One side believes in profit sharing, bringing the mass of workers in to share some of the profits that, after all, the workers help to produce. Whereas the other wing of the family on the board is more interested in distributing the profits to the shareholders, namely to themselves. So we have a difference in philosophy, a difference in deciding what would be best for the long-term interests of the company. Recently, one side was able to persevere and basically fire the other side. The importance isn't who's on what side here. The important thing is what the workers did. They began to say, no, we will not accept this. They stopped working. They did job actions. They called on local politicians, particularly in Massachusetts, to support them, that it was more important, in their view, for the long-term health of the company, but also of the communities the company serves, to be interested in profit sharing rather than distributing profits to a tiny number of family members. And the politicians heard them. And guess what? It is becoming a contentious issue all over New England. What happens here? Workers are beginning to shape, or demand to shape, how corporations use the profits, which the workers point out they are the ones who help to produce, and also that the community should have a say because it will be affected in how these profits are used. Well, as I thought about this, an old story from history came back into my mind, and I wanted to share it. You know, for hundreds of years back in the Middle Ages, human beings struggled when there was time for one king to oust another king or one prince to replace another prince. The people, when they could clearly see that one prince was much better for the average person than the other one, they would go out and they would do things, demonstrate, parade, have marches, have petitions, favoring one king over the other, one prince over the other. And in a way, the workers at Market Basket are struggling to favor one member of the family that owns and operates Market Basket over another. But imagine what might happen in the future in this country that is parallel to what happened in medieval times. Eventually, people got tired of supporting the good king versus the not-so-good one, the better prince against the lesser one. They began to say, wait a minute, we all depend on what's done with those profits. We all depend on what's done, we all participate in making those profits. Just like in the old times, in the medieval time, everybody said, hey, we make this society go. We depend on what these kings do. Why should we allow a king to make a decision over how to use the resources we help to produce and upon which we depend? You know, it's a very parallel struggle. And the people around Market Basket in New England, I think, will also soon recognize that we really oughtn't to be struggling over which member of the ruling family calls the shots. It really oughtn't to be that way, should it? In a democratic arrangement, all of the people, all those who work at Market Basket, and all those who depend on how Market Basket evolves, because that's where they get their groceries, should together and democratically decide what happens. It doesn't make any more sense to have a tiny group of people who are there, by the way, because they inherited something, just like the medieval kings, make all the decisions. That's not democratic. And it's interesting that the people in Seattle in their way and the people in New England in their way are beginning to move and act to realize that understanding. Next update has to do with Derek Jeter, the justly famous, extraordinarily skilled shortstop for the New York Yankees baseball team. As many of you probably know, he announced recently that this would be his last year as a professional baseball player. He's also the captain of the New York Yankees team. Why do I bring this up? Because his announcement means that the remaining games of this year's baseball season, where he plays, will be the last opportunity. People who have followed his career, people who love baseball, this will be the last opportunities they get to see a living legend play the game. And so I was struck by what has been happening to tickets. That is, you can buy tickets in advance for the games that Derek Jeter will be playing for the rest of this year. And I want to give you an idea of what has happened to those tickets. The average list price for the home game in the Bronx against the Kansas City Royals went from $139.24 before Derek Jeter's retirement announcement to $497.98 by Saturday, according to the ticket resale market aggregator TickIQ. And there are many more examples of this happening. Why am I bringing this up? Because this is a market that is working. And since many of you are interested in how markets work, let's take a look at this one. The demand of people to see Derek Jeter play in the final games of his remarkable career is perfectly understandable. I admire it, as I admire the skill that he has always shown and also the way he's carried himself as a leader of that team. I understand that there are huge numbers of people who want to see, who followed his career, who want to be there, who want to cheer him on and to show their appreciation for what he's brought to the game. How does the market work? Does it allocate tickets to the people who have followed the game for the longest time? No. Does it allocate tickets to the people who want the most, who believe in baseball? Young people, for example, that are contemplating a career and for whom he represents a model? No. The tickets will be occupied by whoever has the most money and can afford to buy these tickets at these escalating prices. The market gives this opportunity to a person who may have stolen most of the money, a person who may have inherited from someone, a person who may have worked hard for it, a person who may have lucked out for it. The market allocates to whoever got the money, and it doesn't ask where you got it or how you got it. It doesn't ask anything about whether you deserve this opportunity. If there are loads of people who want to see Derek Jeter, but only a certain number for whom there are seats, how do we allocate? Should we, for example, give some to young people? Should we give some to real fans? What is the rule? The market doesn't care. The market has one rule. You got the money, you get the ticket. Is that the way we want to distribute scarce things like tickets to Derek Jeter's final game? Quickly, two more updates that we have time for. Over the last week, a scandal erupted in China, and once again it had to do with food processing. It turns out that many McDonald's restaurants in China and many KFC and other well-known chains of fast food in China had been serving meat that had been processed in a particular factory in China. And it turned out that a local media outlet, a local newspaper, radio station, took cameras secretly into where the meat was prepared, showing that the meat being used was days, weeks, and in some cases, months beyond its expiration date. Meat was being used that had fallen off the tables and onto the floor and simply scooped back in to produce hamburgers, to produce chicken nuggets, and all the rest. A scandal arose. And the newspapers in the United States that I glanced at were full of stories about Chinese industry being unsafe when it comes to eating. So I wanted to bring to your attention that the factories in question, and by the way, McDonald's is still using those factories, or at least the company that runs those factories, whereas KFC, Yum! Brands, a big fast food retailer, has said they won't touch anything from that company anymore. But here's the thing I wanted to bring to your attention. The company in question isn't Chinese. It's American. The OSI Group from the Midwest of the United States own and operate that factory where all of these things took place. Needless to say, they are expressing shock, surprise, and awe that such things could happen in one of their factories. The Chinese government is now inspecting all of those factories of that company and shutting down those that they find inadequate. In fact, the lesson here is the Chinese government is behaving better than you might expect. And the American company is the one that's responsible for not policing its own operations, making more money by using meat that should have been thrown away. It's a lesson. The problem isn't America versus China or China versus America. The problem are the imperatives of a profit-driven system that, to make that bottom line look good, will take chances with everything, including the health of what we eat. Okay, let me turn now to the part of our program where we deal with larger issues, issues that take a little longer to get into than those shorter updates with which we begin. And the first one that I want to deal with you today is about President Obama. And I want to do an economic analysis with you, for you, of something about President Obama that you may not have thought about. Recently, President Obama has suffered from very poor poll numbers. That is, people are asked by polling outfits across America how they think President Obama is doing, and he's not getting good numbers. A large majority of people express greater or lesser dissatisfaction with his performance as a president. They disagree about what it is they like and don't like, but the numbers are about as bad as he's ever had in his career and represent a serious question: why might this be happening? You can't really point to his critics because they've been critical straight through, particularly the Republicans, in a pretty straight line. So you can't explain it that way too easily. So I thought I'd offer an economic analysis, and here's how that would go. President Obama is really in many ways like the last president who came into office when we were having a major economic crisis. And that president was Franklin Roosevelt in the early 1930s when he got into office. That was then the Great Depression, what we've been in the last 6 years, we've now come to call the Great Recession. Obama came in at the early stages of this breakdown of capitalism, and Roosevelt came in at the early stages of the last one. One of the first things both presidents did was bail out a lot of big banks and other corporations because the economy was literally disintegrating. But as soon as that was over, both presidents were confronted by a pretty solid chorus of people saying to them, okay, now you've bailed out the big company. Now it's time for the government to go very slowly. Don't rock the boat. Don't tax wealthy people. Don't tax corporations. Don't do that to raise money to help the mass of people. That is a dangerous thing to do. If you start helping the mass of people by taxing the rich, you'll discourage business. You'll make the economic situation worse. That's the road to socialism. I'm sure most of you have heard all of this kind of story. These are conservative advisors. They're the dominant group. And they told Roosevelt, take it easy. Capitalism is a system that heals itself. The government intervention doesn't work and usually makes things worse. And the same advice was given to Barack Obama, right after he, like Roosevelt, bailed out the critically wounded financial sector of the United States and huge companies like General Motors, AIG Insurance, and so on. They said, okay, now slow down. Don't go too far. Don't really hit wealthy people and businesses with a tax. That wouldn't make sense. And therefore, you won't have the money to help masses of people because you shouldn't run a deficit either. And if you don't tax corporations and the rich, and if you don't borrow from them, well, then there's no money either to take care of average folks. So he got the same advice President Obama did that Roosevelt did. But here now a difference occurs. Roosevelt, after being in office for a while, made an interesting decision. He decided not to follow the conservative advice. Kind of remarkable because he had always followed it before being president, as he moved up the political ladder. He was a person you'd expect to follow the advice, more or less like we expected it of Barack Obama, or should have, looking at his rising up through the ranks to be a president. But Roosevelt broke away. Roosevelt said, I'm not going to follow the conservative advice. And by the way, the conservatives didn't mince words. They said, if you dare to tax corporations and the rich to help unfortunate people and bums in the street and the unemployed who they wanted to suggest were unemployed because it was their fault, you will commit political suicide. The corporations and the rich will hate you, and they will get you out of office. You better not dare do it. So the conservatives said, we have the best advice, but we also have a little kicker that if you don't follow our advice, you're going to commit political suicide. Against all of that, Roosevelt said, no, I'm not doing it. I am going to do what you tell me not to do. And what did Roosevelt do? He taxed corporations and the rich more highly than ever before. And he used the money to create mass support for the people suffering through the Depression. He created Social Security, the unemployment compensation system, a federal jobs program that hired 15 million people, etc. He broke from the advice. Did it, by the way, produce political suicide for Franklin Roosevelt? Not only did it not do what the conservative advisors had threatened, it did the opposite. Franklin Roosevelt's the most popular president America ever had. He was reelected 4 times. No other president had come close to that. He was looked upon as the savior of the country by most Americans. Very few presidents have come close to that either. So the advice was rejected, and the result was not what the conservatives had predicted. But now let's talk about Obama. He followed the advice. He didn't reject it. He made very limited efforts to tax the rich, and when that didn't go easily through, he didn't make a national campaign out of it. He let it go. And he didn't therefore have the money because he couldn't borrow since he didn't want to have a deficit either. So he didn't tax the rich and didn't borrow from them. And so he couldn't provide the kind of mass help, which is why our recovery has still bypassed the majority of our people. Irony. Barack Obama followed the advice, and while that may have not meant political suicide, it has given him the worst poll ratings of his entire career, and among the worst any president has had at a comparable point in his presidency. If Mr. Obama's concerned about his legacy, it's not looking real good. He followed the conservative advice, but instead of that saving him from political decline, it seems to have caused it. Final point. What in the end explains the difference between Roosevelt and Barack Obama? The answer is Roosevelt had to change his position. He had to reject the conservative advice because millions of Americans had been organized by the Congress of Industrial Organizations, a new union movement, the CIO, working together with two socialist and one communist parties that were strong and big at that time. The socialists, communists, and the unions worked together and went to Mr. Roosevelt and said, you have to take care of the mass of people or else there's going to be big trouble in this country. And Roosevelt believed them. And Roosevelt then went to the rich and the corporations and said, you're going to have to give me the money to take care of these people or else this whole system's going to fall apart. And he got enough of them to support him. That's what he did. That's why he rejected the advice. But we here now in America, in Barack Obama's America, we have a president who wasn't confronted by a surging labor movement that had organized millions. He's not confronted by a socialist or communist party. We've repressed those in this country out of existence. When there was a little bit of Occupy Wall Street surging up, the president took steps to undermine that. So there couldn't be the kind of groundswell from below that might have persuaded him to do what Roosevelt did. So in effect, Mr. Obama followed the advice and got the worst result. It's something to think about when looking at his difficulties as a president. In the few moments before we take our mid-program break, let me turn to another question that follows directly from this. It has to do, because many of you have written to me and asked me to talk about this, it has to do again with understanding these elusive terms, capitalism, socialism, and communism. So let's do it again, but it's something that bears looking at again, especially now as the criticisms of capitalism are emerging and more people are becoming interested, once again, as has happened before, in alternatives to capitalism. Well, definitions are not simple things. Capitalism has mostly been defined, and indeed for most of the 19th and 20th century, here's how it went. Capitalism is when an enterprise, the institutions that make the goods and services we all depend on, are owned by private individuals, not by the government. So enterprise is private, and enterprises are free to buy and sell in the market whatever it is they need as inputs and whatever it is they produce as outputs. So that capitalism is private enterprise freely transacting in the markets with other companies and with the public. Private enterprise and markets. And what then is socialism? Well, in the 19th and 20th century, socialism was an alternative. It involved the government either controlling or directing enterprises rather than private individuals, or literally the government owning and operating the enterprises. So instead of private enterprise, we had state enterprise. And the second thing that made socialism different from capitalism was that in a socialist economy, we wouldn't rely on market exchanges. Companies and individuals would not be free to buy and sell from one another in the market. Instead, the government would plan and allocate both the resources that go into production and the products that come out. So in simplest language, capitalism was private enterprise and markets as the means to distribute things, whereas socialism was public control or even public ownership of enterprises and government planning and distribution outside of a market. When we come back after our short break, we will elaborate and look further at this distinction between capitalism and socialism. Please stay with us. The break will be short. Welcome back, friends. This is Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I want to quickly remind you of our two websites where you can follow us, where you can send us your own comments, and where you can also click on an icon to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. The first one is rdwolff.com with two Fs, and the second one is Democracy at Work, all one word, democracyatwork.info. Please make use of those websites. We update and maintain them on a continuous basis. And finally, I'd also like to remind you, if you're interested, that on July 25th, I will be with Bill Maher on the Real Time program. If you can, join us, or if you can't, take a look afterwards. I think you'll find it an interesting conversation. We were talking before the break about capitalism and socialism. And quickly to remind you, capitalism for the 19th and 20th century mostly described as private enterprise dealing in markets, freely buying and selling with whoever they wanted to buy from and with whoever they wanted to sell to. Whereas socialism was government control or even government owning and operating the enterprises, and instead of markets being the way we distribute resources and products, instead we have government planning of how to do it. Okay, what then was communism? Well, in point of fact, it's confusing. Communism was thought to be the future endpoint for which socialism was a transition. In other words, folks who believed in socialism and communism understood that they were going beyond capitalism. They were proposing an alternative system, but that the first stage of that would be socialism, government ownership and planning, and some future ultimate place to which they hoped to arrive would be communism. And they didn't understand exactly what that communism would look like, and so it was usually described in very vague ways. For example, a society in which everybody did as much work as they could, and everybody received as much as they needed, to each according to his needs, and from each according to his or her ability. Well, that's a very nice summary, but it is a little vague, to say the least. And the reason it never got very concrete is, and this is very important, that no society, including those run by socialists, ever thought it had reached communism. In other words, whatever collapsed in the Soviet Union in 1989 was socialism, not communism. And whatever collapsed in China, or changed in China, was socialism, not communism, because neither of those societies ever thought they had come close to arriving at that future point of communism. That's important to keep in mind. Yes, they were run by parties calling themselves Communist Party, but they took the name Communist because that signaled where they were going. They didn't take the name Communist because they thought they had already achieved that. That's simply a misunderstanding of what happened. Now, in the 21st century, the definitions are changing. And that's a very interesting thing that I want to drive home because I think it'll help all of us understand what's unfolding in the world. The experiences with socialism as it was actually formed in Eastern Europe, in China, and in several other countries, left a lot of people, including many socialists, deeply dissatisfied. The idea that the government would take over and that you would have planning, whatever its virtues, was seen by these socialists as far from enough. That is, whatever had to be created that would be better than capitalism, simply having the government replace the private sector and having planning replace markets was clearly not enough. What that did was create societies that had some virtues but lots of faults, and that made these socialists and these communists say there has to be much more to the kinds of alternative we are interested in than what was achieved in Russia and China if we are going to be successful in making folks who are dissatisfied with capitalism think about these kinds of things. And so they've changed. And where socialism and communism are going now has much less to do than before with the government and with planning. In other words, the definition of socialism and communism is changing. And I think it has more than a little to do with the dissatisfaction with capitalism that is also mushrooming across the world as a result of the crisis, particularly of the last 6 years. So where is socialism going? Well, it's less concerned with the government and with planning, even though many socialists still believe that government should be playing a major role in the economy, and that planning should likewise, but they've become much more loose about whether the government should alone be involved or whether there ought to be also private, non-governmental enterprises. They've become a bit more loose about whether the planning should be everything or whether maybe there's a role for planning and markets in some relationship. That's a topic that they continue to debate, but it isn't quite so clearly either or the way it once was. And not only is that the case, but here's the important thing. The focus has gone away from government versus private and from market versus plan. The focus has become more and more on the enterprise itself, on the micro level, you might say, on the thing, the business, the enterprise, the firm, the company, whatever word you want. That place, the workplace, where we actually get together with fellow citizens to make the goods and services that our lives depend on. Socialism beginning to mean more and more a different way of organizing production. That capitalism is one way and socialism is another. It's not about the government, and it's not about planning and markets. It's about how do you organize those 8 hours, 5 days a week that we go to work and interact on the job with all that that means to our incomes, to our sense of ourselves, to our relationships with other people, to how we feel about the world, and so on. So let me end today's discussion by saying the capitalist way is epitomized by the modern corporation. A large number of people who come to work 5 days a week, 9 to 5, who arrive, go to work, do what they're told with equipment that's provided for them, and at the end of the day, they go home, they leave behind what they've produced, and they can go home, do whatever they want, and come back the next day and do it all again. A tiny group of people, major shareholders, 10 or 20, and the board of directors they select, another 10 or 20. Those people, together, 20 or 30 people, they make the decisions. They decide what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. The profits everybody helped to produce, but they alone decide how to make use of them. That's why there are the struggles that we talked about earlier in this program. For example, at the market basket chain of supermarkets. Who decides? In a capitalist enterprise, we have this ownership, board of directors, decision makers, mass of the workers live with the results of the decision, but are excluded from participating in them. 21st century socialism says, yes, exactly, that's where we propose an alternative. And the alternative is a democratic enterprise, an enterprise in which all the people who work there together, one person, one vote, make the basic decisions. They become their own board of directors, all of them. They decide what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and above all, what to do with the profits that all of their efforts helped to create. That is a notion that the modern socialists have, which they think will be much more attractive in drawing the people becoming disaffected with capitalism than a repetition of the 19th and 20th century image about government and planning. In future programs, we'll deal with this some more, but it is clearly also something you might want to think about because you, the listener, are going to be caught up in these debates and in these choosings, if you like, among alternatives. The last major topic for which we will have time today has to do with an argument that I hear a lot and that you have asked me to talk about and that I want to address. And this is an argument having to do with whether doing something that's profitable is a sign of efficiency. And I'm going to try to make a theoretical case and then give you a concrete example. It's very important that you understand, whenever you hear this kind of thing, that profits refer to the costs and revenues of a profit-making company. In other words, let's take an example. A casino in Atlantic City decides that it's profitable to expand or to build a new casino, which they did in the 80s and 90s in Atlantic City, major casino companies. It's profitable. What did they mean? They meant that when they looked at the situation, they knew what they would have to pay to all the workers. They knew what they would have to pay for the electricity. They knew what they would have to pay for rent. And then they also calculated what they would get as income, how many people would come to the casino, how much would they spend on food and on drink and on gambling. And they also asked, how many subsidies can we get from the city of Atlantic City, from the state of New Jersey, maybe even from the federal government? What kind of tax gimmicks can we legally exploit, et cetera, et cetera? And they figured all that out, and if there was a net revenue, more coming in than they had to spend, they could make a profit, and if that profit was high enough, they made the decision. But there's nothing to deduce from that. There's no conclusion you can draw that what's profitable is what's good for the community. Let me give you an example. Part of the calculation of profit is how many millions of dollars they got in tax breaks and subsidies from Atlantic City, from New Jersey, and so on. The real question there is, what else could have been done with that money? For the company, they don't care. For them, they got it, and so they decided they're going to use it. But we may, if we're looking at it, may decide, wow, that money could have been used for something much, much more valuable to many more people than another gambling casino. So what's good for the community, what's efficient for our society, is a very different matter from what is privately profitable to a company. I chose the Atlantic City because Atlantic City is now facing a crisis. Three or four of the major casinos are closing in Atlantic City, threatening to plunge that city into the poverty-stricken disaster that it was back in the 1960s and 70s, before gambling came there. The companies are closing. Why? Because they are finding it more profitable to open new casinos in Maryland, Pennsylvania, and New York, perhaps closer to where people who gamble would want to and be able to go, perhaps because they can get new subsidies from those states that are even bigger than anything they can get from New Jersey. There are many reasons, but they're creating a disaster in Atlantic City and a boom outside of Washington or the other places where they are going to be building them. They're doing what they're doing because it's privately profitable to them. But if we count as a society, what will happen to the people, to the housing, to the schools of Atlantic City. That's a real cost, not a cost for the company, so it doesn't show up in their private profit calculations, but a cost for us as a society. And I'm not even going into what it means that we'll be spending billions, with a B, billions of dollars in this day and age, when we are shutting schools, when we are not taking care of our infrastructure, our roads, our harbors, when we have crucial social needs. What does it mean that we're not doing that, but we're spending billions on casinos, new casinos, while we abandon the old ones? Privately profitable, yes. Socially useful? Socially valuable? I don't think so. And it's long overdue that we not make the mistake of thinking that something that's privately profitable is therefore socially desirable, socially efficient, or anything else. For companies to suggest that what they do for their profit is what's the best thing for the society as a whole is an obvious self-serving proposition that no reasonable person should take seriously. Okay, in the time that we have left, I would like to deal with some of your questions. And to stay with our topic today, which is about profit and social benefit and all of that, I wanted to begin by talking about two examples of where we allow private profits to dictate a situation that literally makes no sense and hasn't for a long time. The two examples are major in our society, the automobile industry and the beef industry. Let's start with the automobile industry. Automobiles, and we have major companies, General Motors, Ford, Toyota, and so on. You know them. They are earning profits, most of them. And profits are not huge, and the profits, as usual, have to do with what only the costs they have to cover and only the income they get. And it includes, for General Motors, of course, the enormous bailout subsidy that the federal government gave them, $50 billion. And that's true for other of the companies on a lower scale. And it doesn't include the costs of a collapsed Detroit, which they don't have to calculate because it's not their problem. So they're profitable. But is the automobile industry something we think is a reasonable institution? Let me just introduce to you a few thoughts. One, the automobile kills more people than anything else in our society, and it wounds more people. That is, car accidents are a major source of unspeakable loss in our society every year. Number two, the automobile is the single largest polluter of the air. Number three, the automobile is a stupefyingly inefficient use of energy. To have one person sitting in a car uses an amount of oil, for example, to travel a mile that is completely out of control relative to how much energy we could use to move a person a mile if that person were in a bus or a trolley or a train or a van. In other words, our individual automobile industry is a health disaster, a life and death matter, and a colossal waste of energy that is part of our global warming crisis, etc., etc. A rational transportation program would long ago have switched us to a major reliance on vans and buses and trains and all of the ways that you can reduce accidents, traffic, delay, pollution, energy waste. I mean, this is not rocket science, friends. We could still have some private automobiles. They'd be on the edge of every city, and we know how to do that because that's what Hertz and Avis and all the other rent-a-cars have been doing for decades. But it would be run by our society. If you actually need a private car on some occasion, it would be available. But the basic way we move people would be energy efficient, less dangerous, etc., etc. Private profits of the companies that are into the car and into the energy that they can sell to all the car drivers, they call the shot. But let's face it, We're having a transportation industry that serves profit, but it does not serve a rational sense of our interest and needs as a society. Beef is another one. Recent studies reported by the BBC and others indicate that for a pound of beef, we have to use up more of the environment, more of our land, and more of our resources, way more than to get the same amount of protein into our bodies from pork, chicken, eggs, dairy, and so on. This is, again, a no-brainer. Why do we rely so heavily on that kind of protein that is the most expensive in terms of land, of resources, of climate? It's astonishing. Why don't we sit down and talk about, as a nation, how we might benefit from relying more on other sources of protein? And the answer isn't that we're stupid, and the answer isn't that the science isn't there. The answer is that the beef industry and everything that has grown up around it wants to continue to make their private profits. And if that's at the expense of social welfare, well, too bad. That to me leaves the rest of us with, are we willing to live in the too bad that they have assigned us to? I hope not, for them as well as for us. Another question that came in this last week had to do with credit unions. I had mentioned credit unions, and this person wanted me to talk a little bit more about them in relationship to workers' self-directed enterprises, this idea of a change of how we organize our enterprises from top-down hierarchical, the typical capitalist corporation way, to a cooperative or a workers' cooperative type of alternative. And I think that credit unions are an important step in that direction, because credit unions are a recognition that people want to do their banking, a very important part of life, not with a conventional private bank that's in it to make money, to have a profit, to get that bottom line the way they want it. They would rather put their credit needs and put their confidence in a collective effort of people like themselves to manage together their needs for banking, for credit cards, for loans, and all the rest. It's an instinctual understanding that I think is very promising and exists in the many millions of Americans that are active participants in credit unions, that there is a better way of handling that collectively, democratically, through a joint effort of similar people, rather than relying on a capitalist, profit-driven enterprise. So I think that's a very important step. But it's only a step, partly because private banks have put enormous limits on what credit unions can do, from whom they can take deposits, to whom they can make loans, for what purposes. All of that is rigidly controlled, and that's mainly because the private banks are afraid of the competition that could come if credit unions were free to do more. That's the first thing. The second thing is, a credit union is about a co-op among the people that are using credit. It's not necessarily a co-op in how the actual credit union's employees themselves are organized. So it would be another step for credit unions, one that I hope they will consider in the years ahead, to organize themselves as worker co-ops, even as they expand the cooperation among people that was the basic idea of a credit union. So for me, there are these extra steps that the credit unions have to take. I hope they will. I hope that workers' co-ops will build relationships with credit unions. That, I think, is a marriage made in heaven, in the sense that one of the things worker co-ops need to get going is financing. One of the things credit unions have is a lot of their depositors' money, and they're looking for something that those depositors can be assured will be safe, but also something that those depositors, as themselves members of a collective effort, would believe in. And I think a worker co-op, one with good prospects, would be a proper outlet for the loans that credit union can make. And if the credit unions helped by loans to the worker co-ops, well, then the worker co-ops would have that much more reason to do their banking and the banking of their members with the credit union. In other words, they build each other up as an alternative sector to both private banking and the capitalist organization of enterprises, because they would be alternatives to both of them. That's where I would hope the credit union movement can go. The last topic that someone sent me was a cautionary kind of comment, and I get this fairly often too, which is one of the reasons I chose to respond. The question goes like this. I'm a little worried about enterprises organized by the workers. I have seen too many enterprises and too many efforts by groups of people result in a few bullies rising to the top and calling all the shots. I understand your critique of conventional enterprises, and I understand your appeal to the worker self-directed enterprises, but what's going to happen to prevent those from being taken over by aggressive bully-type people? I think it's a good question. I think we have to develop the following understanding. Every effort by collectives of people working together has a risk that some among them will abuse the group, will try to get special privileges, special position for them. That's a risk. Human beings being what they are, institutions have to be set up to limit that. But a worker self-directed enterprise is not alone in that situation. You know, every large corporation is run by a board of directors. They typically have 20 people. That's a collective. They have to work that out amongst themselves, and they run the risk of having bullies, and they've worked out mechanisms to try to stop it. Worker self-directed enterprises are going to have to do the same. Checks and balances, limits, rotation of function. There are lots of ways to limit the problem of bullies. But we don't solve that when we shift from capitalism to a better system, a newer system. We'll still have problems to solve, and we have to pay attention to them. And I'd be the first one to admit that that's one that we will have to pay close attention to. We've come to the end of our time. I want to express my appreciation for all of you that listen and send me your comments. Please continue to do so. This is Economic Update, and I look forward to being with you again next week.